Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Iraq reels, an American response, a Benghazi capture. After days of deliberation, the president announced U.S. troops, special forces, headed back to Iraq.
We're prepared to send a small number of additional American military advisors, up to 300, to assess how we can best train, advise, and support Iraqi security forces going forward.
A year and a half after the Benghazi attack, a U.S. arrest in Libya. Here's FBI Director James Comey.
The message is, we will shrink the world to find you. We will shrink the world to bring you to justice, and this is a good example of that.
And at the World Cup Round 1, the U.S. snagged victory over Ghana in the final minutes of the game. America's John Brooks with the header.
What about that? It's John Brooks! It's John Brooks for the USA!
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Kimberly Dozier of the Daily Beast, James Oliphant of National Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is the president right? Back to Iraq? Should we stay out, get in? And what do you think on Benghazi, the IRS, the Redskins? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from Washington, Kimberly Dozier, contributing editor at The Daily Beast, former intelligence and counterterrorism reporter for the Associated Press. She covered the war in Iraq for CBS News from 2003 until she was wounded in a Baghdad car bombing in 2006. Now it's all back in the news. Kimberly Dozier, welcome to On Point.
Great to be here. Wishing we're for this reason.
Yes, don't we all? And from Washington, James Oliphant, White House correspondent for National Journal, is with us. James, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Kimberly, and James.
Here is the president yesterday at the White House after all these days of waiting. Here's what he had to say about what U.S. forces might be doing.
Going forward, we will be prepared to take targeted and precise military action if and when we determine that the situation on the ground requires it. If we do, I will consult closely with Congress and leaders in Iraq and in the region.
But doesn't have to come to Congress for permission. He said, Nancy Pelosi said, Kimberly Dozier, he's talking about 300 special forces in Iraq. That seems like a small number. What would they do? And what is he holding in reserve here when it comes to targeted and precise military action?
Well, he is still considering airstrikes by either drone or jet. But to do that, you need better intelligence. You also need U.S. forces out in small numbers with the Iraqi forces to make sure that there won't be any incidents of friendly fire. You need people who are skilled at sending messages up to the American birds in the sky saying, we're here. The other problem is they don't know where ISIS or ISIL, if you want to call them either name, is the Islamic militants who are surging south. A lot of them are dressed in civilian clothes. They are mixed in with the urban population. They're not heading south in columns of tanks. So the U.S. needs better intelligence either to conduct its own strikes or to help the Iraqis be more effective. These Green Beret forces or other military advisors that will be spreading out throughout the headquarters ranks of the Iraqi military will be doing everything from talking to the senior Iraqi commanders and asking them, what tactics are you using? How are you tracking the movement of the fighters? Where are your forces? How good is your command and control? To also gathering information, being able to relay back to Washington, these guys are or are not keeping it together in this particular unit. They'll also be able to keep an eye out for any actors coming in from Iran, from the Iranian Quds Force. They'll be able to look for malign influences within the Iraqi military. All of this is intelligence that the White House desperately needs before it can make any further decisions to move forward.
And, of course, by many reports, Iran, they're already advising the Iraqi military. Americans could well find themselves in parallel roles, even alongside them. The president saying yesterday, we won't go further than this. It won't be combat troops.
I think we always have to guard against mission creep. So let me repeat what I've said in the past. American combat troops are not going to be fighting in Iraq again.
Well, so he's saying this week, but we know how these things can roll. Americans have watched this in many countries. You talk about military advisors and who knows. James Oliphant, give us a sense of the struggle in the White House, if it has been a struggle, over where to come down on what to do here in Iraq. There were days of conversations going on. What do you know about the internal range of options considered and the process that led to the decision?
Well, I think what we've seen, Tom, is that the White House has sort of taken a step backward, and they're really looking for a political solution more than a military solution in Iraq. There was a lot of talk early last week when ISIS was on the march about some sort of quick airstrike or some sort of action to stall their march toward Baghdad. But I think as the Iraqi security forces have sort of dug in, it's given the White House a little bit of a breather to try to put pressure on the Iraqi government to reform and create a more inclusive structure that will give the Sunni minority a greater voice. And that's really, I think, what the White House is hoping to do here is they do not want to engage militarily if they don't have to. And frankly, politically, this is the last thing it needs right now.
I mean, are they anywhere, though, on an arc of action, or do we see developments that could defuse this? You talk about changing the government, including Sunnis more. Why would the Sunnis even want to talk? They're in there with ISIS. They're taking over territory. They've practically taken over the largest refinery in Iraq now. Why talk with Maliki or even his successor when they might have their own state emerging here, James?
Well, and I'm sure Kimberly can speak to this, but the Sunnis in Iraq are not monolithic. There are more moderate elements. There are elements, as we saw during the war, that want a thriving Iraq. I don't think, as President Obama likes to say, that this is not a zero-sum game. Now, the problem is that these, because of the political process and because of the actions of the Prime Minister al-Maliki, that the Sunnis feel marginalized. And so moderate elements that might have worked with the government instead are finding themselves aligning with the insurgency. And the hope is that the United States diplomatically and can put some pressure on the government, on the Shiite majority, to take a step back and try to develop a more inclusive political process.
Not ours to choose Iraq's leaders, the president said yesterday, but it was pretty clear that the president of the United States would like somebody else in there in charge in Iraq.
Now, it's not the place for the United States to choose Iraq's leaders. It is clear, though, that only leaders that can govern with an inclusive agenda are going to be able to truly bring the Iraqi people together and help them through this crisis.
Jack Beatty, what a week and a half. 9 years nearly of American troops in there, 4,500 plus lives lost, trillions spent, and the map of Iraq changed in little more than a week, and it's still changing, Jack.
Yes, and it's ignited a debate that we're going to hear a lot about in coming weeks, months, probably years. Who lost Iraq? We had who lost China, who lost Vietnam. Now, who lost Iraq? John McCain said, we've lost the peace. This administration has botched it. He puts his finger on incompetence. Dick Cheney almost hints at treason, that the president wanted something bad to happen. We're going to hear more and more of that. And that argument really has two nodes. One, 2011 and the status of forces agreement. If you say Obama lost Iraq, His critics say, here's where he lost it. He didn't get that agreement. We didn't keep forces there. Ergo, we lost all the progress we had made because we didn't have people on the ground. Well, what are the facts of that? Well, yesterday we had Max Boot, a well-known advocate of intervention in Iraq, on our show, and he said, look at the book of Michael Gordon on this, and that's the word. I looked at the book, and in the... The key idea there is, on the one hand, the Iraqis wanted to refer the decision to sign this agreement to the parliament. And we at first said, no, that'll be impossible. But then we said, yes, we have to have the parliament sign because that'll be the only airtight agreement that will protect American soldiers against being prosecuted. We have to have the parliament on board. That was one side. And then on the other side, the administration kept limiting the amount of troops. It started at 10,000, came down to 5,000, and finally it was 3,000. And frankly, the Iraqi politicians didn't want to take a chance on committing themselves to such a minimal gain of troops because it would be so politically controversial. That's the key point where people are going to go and say, Obama lost Iraq, he lost it there. There are counterarguments, but that's the shape of it. The second place, of course, is Syria. We heard this in interviews with Secretary of State Clinton this week. You lost it in Syria because if you had done what we said, Mrs. Clinton, Petraeus, others, what we had said in 2012 and intervened in Syria, helped the moderate opposition, we could have staunched ISIS in the bud, and this wouldn't have happened. Those two things will come up again and again.
Who lost Iraq? On the other hand, Kimberly Dozier, we talked with Tom Ricks, our friend this week, off mic this a couple of days ago, and he's saying, look, he's glad there aren't American forces left behind there. They would be in trouble now. You know, we had 150,000 plus, and it wasn't easy. If you had 3,000, 5,000, 10,000 in the midst of this kind of problem, they could be in trouble again, Kimberly.
Well, actually, look at it another way. Had you had 3,000 some odd American forces spread in different locations, they would have enabled CIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, and NSA operatives to work further out in the field and gather intelligence. U.S. intelligence officials have told me they didn't have any way really to detect the forces coming across from Syria. Had you had U.S. forces out in the field and intelligence folks with them, maybe we would have known faster.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, blow up in Iraq, an American response, a Benghazi arrest, GOP politics, the Redskins feel the heat. James Oliphant is with us, White House correspondent for National Journal. Kimberly Dozier is with us, contributing editor at The Daily Beast, former intelligence and counterterrorism reporter for the Associated Press, author of Breathing the Fire. Spent a lot of time in Iraq herself. There was some real hot rhetoric out this week. John McCain on the floor of the Senate saying Rome is burning.
First of all, we have to understand there are no good options. There are no good options remaining. This is a culmination of failure after failure of this administration. But for us to do nothing now will ensure this base for terrorism.
Dick Cheney piling on in a big op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal, really going after the Obama administration. Here he was talking on Fox News.
Barack Obama has stated repeatedly the terrorist threat's gone. We got bin Laden. That's clearly not the true case. That's not the truth. And in fact, we have a situation tonight where terrorism is potentially in charge of a larger part of the Middle East than ever before in our history.
A couple of responses to that. One from Harry Reid, Senate Majority Leader, Democrat, of course. You can imagine what he would say, and here it was.
There's one thing that this country does not need. It's that we should be taking advice from Dick Cheney on wars.
But the most interesting response, in a way, came from Fox itself. Fox host Megyn Kelly asked Dick Cheney about his criticism of President Obama. And here she is, specifically this op-ed piece, where he had written, "Rarely has a U.S. president been so wrong about so much at the expense of so many." The Fox News host, Megyn Kelly, turned it around on the former Vice President, Dick Cheney.
Time and time again, history has proven that you got it wrong as well in Iraq, sir. You said there was no doubt Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. You said we would be greeted as liberators. You said the Iraq insurgency was in the last throes back in 2005. And you said that after our intervention, extremists would have to, quote, rethink their strategy of jihad. Now, with almost $1 trillion spent there, with 4,500 American lives lost there, what do you say to those who say you were so wrong about so much at the expense of so many?
No, I just fundamentally disagree, Reagan. Megan, you've got to go back and look at the track record.
Reagan, he wishes it was. It wasn't. It was Megyn Kelly. Jack Beatty, that was some laying out. Can you imagine what was going on in the vice president's mind, wondering, where am I? Is this Fox News?
You know, good for her. I mean, I think almost anybody would have to say that. That's as tough a question as I've ever heard a politician asked, and it was asked by a friendly, or what someone he assumed was friendly, and I think it's a kudos to Fox News for their integrity there.
So here we are, Kimberly. The question of Iran has come up throughout the last couple of weeks here. And would the U.S. work with Iran? What's Iran saying about that? Is it inevitable? If we're in there now, when Iraq's back is against the Shia government with its allies in Iran, if their back is against the wall, is it inevitable that we're cheek by jowl with Iranian forces, advisors, intelligence in Baghdad?
Well, both the White House and the Iranian government have taken steps to correct that, saying that, look, we'll talk about coordinating our efforts politically to perhaps pressure the Maliki government or help them be more effective, depending on which side you are delivering that message. But they have both said that they won't be putting combat forces in. That said, there are Quds Force advisors in Baghdad right now, and we're being told at the Daily Beast that they are making offers of armed help without the kind of strings attached that the Americans have offered. So you do have a little bit of a bidding war going on for the Maliki government's favor. Where that leaves U.S. help, well, we still have to reach out to Iran to make sure, if nothing else, that we deconflict our military efforts. You don't want a U.S. Surveillance plane straying too far into Iranian airspace and being mistaken, that sort of thing. It does represent an opportunity for the two sides to be talking about a regional issue, but it really does remind me of two boxers circling each other in the ring and deciding, okay, where could I land a punch here that the other one doesn't notice?
Kimberly, where is American leverage here compared to Iran's? Iran is right next door. They've been working with Iraq throughout all of this. They've got huge influence here. We're going to have 300 special forces and maybe some airstrikes, but beyond that, where's our leverage with Iraq now?
Well, you know, if you're the Maliki government, you're fully cognizant of that. You know that Iran has a lot to offer, and you know that the White House is dragging its feet every step of the way. But you want to keep the White House on side, so you keep playing this game and asking what they'll give you. But we understand the Maliki government hasn't offered basing rights for U.S. planes, and it hasn't offered even a kind of a short-term immunity for U.S. troops coming in. That's why the president has to keep the aid so small. So, yeah, the U.S. has its influence to offer, but it's so publicly reluctant that in the souk, it's probably not going to do too well in this bargain.
And right on the border of Iraq, the Iranian President Hassan Rouhani talking to a crowd at a stadium this week, saying that under some circumstances, he, Iran, would be ready to intervene in the Iraq crisis. Here he is interpreted by Iranian state-owned Press TV.
To all superpowers, their mercenaries, assassins, and terrorists, we declare that the great Iranian nation will spare no efforts to protect the dignity of Iraq's holy shrines.
And that phrase is big. These are very important shrines, can justify a lot. James Oliphant, do you see the White House feeling a readiness to dance in a new way with Iran here? How would that affect nuclear talks going on in Vienna? How would that affect U.S. relations with the rest of the region where they've got alliances and allies very much opposed to Iran?
Well, Tom, as Kimberly noted, they're doing sort of a two-step here, and that is that they are engaging diplomatically. They don't want to engage militarily. There is some opportunity for dialogue, but there's a great risk, as you noted. The United States really does not want to be seen as being on behalf of one side of a sectarian conflict here. And, you know, that's something that's going to alarm allies in Saudi Arabia and some other places in the Middle East. And so they have to walk this very, very delicate line about trying to perhaps get some help. And they also have to be in a position to check the Iranians. And they don't want to create – what they don't want is a power vacuum where Iran could move in. The country breaks apart, and then Iran seizes Baghdad or some portion of Baghdad and the oil fields to the south, which is a very critical component of all of this.
I mean, they barely have to seize them at this point. They've got the hand is in the sock puppet here. Andy in Des Moines, Iowa. Andy, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I just wanted to respond to the discussion about why this is happening or whose fault it is. And I think that not intervening in Syria and the decision to remove all the troops from Iraq were mentioned, but that's exactly what the American people wanted. And, you know, there's a reason that John McCain isn't in the Oval Office making these decisions, and it's because we also don't want troops there after this fact.
No troops. The president says no troops. Are you confident it will be no troops, Andy, with special forces in Baghdad? Combat troops?
I would imagine that just like when the discussion came up last summer about even doing military strikes in Syria, the American people were adamantly against that. And I would imagine that expanding a war that a lot of Americans didn't even want to go into in the first place would be kind of a non-starter.
Yeah, though there's been plenty of calls for more action here. And what happened in Syria, Jack, to your Who Lost Iraq anticipated conversation through 2016, it extends into Syria. We heard at a town hall meeting on CNN on Tuesday, Hillary Clinton was there. She said she urged President Obama to arm moderate Syrian rebels when she was Secretary of State, saying, "We pushed very hard." You can hear her trying to carve out her own turf here, but said she understood why the president ultimately made the decision he did, Hillary Clinton.
I said we should have done it, you know, 2+ years ago, but I want to be very clear. These are difficult, hard choices. If it was so self-evident that everybody should have done this, we wouldn't be sitting here talking about what we didn't do, but we might be talking about consequences of what we did do.
You can hear the potential Democratic nominee in 2016 there looking for some distance. I said we should have done it. Armed moderates in Syria. That could be important back script, Jack.
Oh, yes, yes. She gave herself some room there, but very carefully said, of course, maybe everything that could have been counterproductive. I thought it was very deftly done on her part. You know, Andy makes a really good point. Barack Obama got the Democratic nomination because he was right about Iraq. In real time, he said this was a dumb war, we shouldn't do it. In real time, Hillary Clinton voted for the war. He got the nomination for that reason. Many people think he won the presidency for that reason. His opponent, as Andy said, John McCain, this week the Washington Post said he has, quote, made noises about U.S. military involvement. This is in the recent years in, quote, Nigeria, Ukraine, Syria, Mali, North Korea, Iran, Libya, Afghanistan, Kosovo, Bosnia, Sudan, and, of course, Iraq. That's John McCain. Any problem, send the troops, send the bombs, do what you will. He has no credibility on these matters, it seems to me, with this people who defend the president's instincts toward peace would say. And, you know, if Obama stands for anything in foreign policy is we don't do intervention. We're not going there. And this intervention now, along with the much bigger escalation in Afghanistan, now tapered down, now gone, that's the exception in his presidency. And he was massively reluctant in 2011 to have our forces there, even though they were trying to work out this agreement. He was massively reluctant to get involved in Syria. And as Andy said, that is what the public wants. Yet, the president's approval ratings on foreign policy now are at 37%, the lowest yet, even though he's doing pretty much what the public wants. It is a paradox.
Kim, what do you make of that? 37%, this is the lowest performance of his presidency on foreign policy. It's dragging down all of his ratings with the public. This is very low. Now, Congress, very low as well. This week I saw 7%, an all-time low for Congress as well. But people are looking at this president with these crises around him and saying, he doesn't have the gas in the tank to take it on through the rest of his presidency. He doesn't have the public support.
Well, just because the public asks you to do X, Y, or Z, that they wanted a drawdown overseas, they also want results and performance. That's not exactly fair, but that's the way it is. What we see happening in Syria right now is, you know, people are turning on their television screens, listening to their radios, and hearing about this growing Islamic militant movement there that could rival and or surpass the threat of al-Qaeda to the United States. Syria is becoming a training ground for foreign fighters that many different military officers I've spoken to have just kind of shaken their head and said, you know, we are going to be dealing with the veterans from this conflict for years to come. So, you know, Americans are looking at that and going, I don't want to be on the ground. I don't want troops in the middle of it. I don't want those awful headlines every night of injured troops coming home. But what's going on here? I mean, that's the way I read it. And the same thing in Iraq. Yes, people were tired of war just like they are in Afghanistan, but they also wanted it to end, quote unquote, the right way. Now they're turning on their television screens and seeing the place in flames again and saying, okay, maybe it's a mess, but maybe there was a better way to handle this. Really? At least that's what I'm hearing from folks in the street that I'm speaking to.
Yeah, Ralph in Prospect, Connecticut. Thanks for calling, Ralph. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I see the issue as a divided country with a deeply hostile environment. You have a group that's going to do anything they can to seize power, and they don't care how it affects the country.
What country are you talking about, Ralph? Iraq? America?
I'm talking about the United States.
Okay.
From day one, when Obama took office, the Republicans have broke a chair over his back, whatever direction he's taken. And right now, whatever side he's going to do, the Republicans are going to take the opposite. Their focus is on 2014 election and the 2016 election. That's the big prize, not America's security.
So with that pressure around him, and it's certainly there, do you think the president is making the right decision here with this toe dip back into Iraq?
I think that this is an issue about oil, and oil affects the planet, and this should be an issue that everybody is in on, not just United States or United States and Iran. I mean, Belgium uses oil, France uses the oil from their region. They've got to be participants in whatever happens there.
Yeah, well, fat chance of that on this side of economic meltdown. Europe's got its own economic woes. Of course, we have them here as well. James Oliphant, how is the White House looking at these pretty terrible numbers on public approval, on handling of foreign policy, and more?
Well, look, I think the caller sort of hit the nail on the head. He was basically channeling the White House argument that, look, what can we do? The Republicans are obstructionists. They're not going to work with us. We've seen the president all year talk about executive action. But I think that has sort of let the White House off the hook a bit. You know, if you want to revive a phrase from the old Iraq days, the president really hasn't done a great job at winning hearts and minds in the country. And we've seen sort of a steady trickle now. It's not just foreign policy. Foreign policy, I think his ratings there are symptomatic of sort of just an overall loss of confidence that we see dating back to last summer with drawing the red line in Syria and the not doing anything, and then the rollout of the Affordable Care Act. And since then, you know, from Ukraine to the Veterans Administration scandal to the Bergdahl prisoner transfer, things have just not gone the White House's way. And so, you know, the people who are around the president tend to see things through the framework of, well, there's some portion of the country that's always going to disagree with him, so there's nothing we can do. But he has lost ground with a group of voters that were willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. And the question, I think, for him going forward is whether he can get those people back.
Jack. You know, the really damning number confirms that James's point about it. It goes to a majority of respondents now think the president is no longer able to lead the country. Competence. People don't think he's competent.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Amazon rolls out its own smartphone, the Amazon Fire. It's a phone and a buying platform off Amazon.
Music's playing, a song's playing. You can instantly find out what that song is. You can find tickets.
That's really cool. I would use that a lot.
It's almost like the world is a hyperlink.
Yeah, the world is your shopping basket. The U.S. Patent Office canceled the Washington Redskins trademark, found it denigrating of Native Americans. But former Redskins linebacker LeVar Arrington said he and fans would understand if the Redskins name has to go.
I think it might take a little bit of time for a lot of diehards to get over the whole change, but I think that it's such a strong fan base that they would adjust.
Maybe it's time. And legendary DJ Mr. American Top 40 Casey Kasem died Sunday at 82. Here's his signature sign-off.
My name's Casey Kasem, reminding you to keep your feet in the ground and keep reaching for the stars.
We're looking at a week in the news. Blow up in Iraq, an American response, a Benghazi arrest, GOP politics, the Redskins feel the heat on that name. With Kimberly Dozier from the Daily Beast, James Oliphant from National Journal, and our own Jack Beatty. Arrest in the desert at night, we're told, in Libya of one of those allegedly involved in the Benghazi attack. Here at an event in Pittsburgh on Tuesday, President Obama spoke about the capture of suspected Benghazi ringleader Ahmed Abu Qatala.
It's important for us to send a message to the world that when Americans are attacked, no matter how long it takes, we will find those responsible and we will bring them to justice.
Speaking with NBC on Tuesday, California Republican Daryl Issa said it took too long.
We knew where he was. He's been doing television interviews. We certainly could have taken him any time, even 6 months ago.
Kimberly Dozier, what about the timing of this raid? Did it take too long? How was he apprehended?
Well, they were planning to nab him last year. They had a sealed indictment against him, but the Libyan government simply fell apart after the arrest of another high-profile al-Qaeda operative by Special Operations Forces. So this Special Operations raid that got Ahmed Abu Qatala had to be delayed. They didn't want to lose their allies for one guy. So what happened was they waited until a time of more stability, and then U.S. Special Operations Forces also waited until their target had come back from fighting. That Libya is so unstable that right now a former Gaddafi loyalist is fighting militant groups in the Benghazi area. So Qatala was taking part in that fighting, came home from that, and the special operations guys were waiting. They tricked their way into his compound. He did resist arrest. He got beat up a bit, but they got him out to a naval ship, and he's now steaming his way back to the U.S. and being interrogated by the high-value interrogation group right now, which is made up of FBI, DOD, CIA folks. They're trying to find out from him any sort of actionable intelligence, anything they can use to head off future attacks against American citizens or American targets. Then they'll turn him over to another FBI team who will interrogate him for legal purposes for the trial. But they wouldn't have nabbed him unless they thought they had already built a case against him that would stand up in this case against him in the U.S. District Court of Washington, D.C.
James Oliphant, no Guantanamo for this Benghazi prisoner. The White House very clear on that.
That's right. And as a matter of fact, Tom, they have not put terrorists that they have grabbed in Guantanamo since the start. And they ruled that out immediately. It's been a point of pride for this president, as well as Eric Holder, the attorney general, that they believe that the federal courts are an appropriate and completely legitimate place to try suspected terrorists. And they've convicted, they say, hundreds. So then they're not going to deviate from that stance.
Kim, does his interrogation at sea as he steams home after being beaten up, as you say, does it get in the way of an American trial?
Well, beaten up as in he resisted arrest.
When he was apprehended. But even so.
And they took him away.
Yeah.
But in terms of the trial, no, this is now a well-established procedure. It was used against the Times Square bomber Faisal Shahzad. It was used on the Boston Marathon suspect Zhakar Tsarnaev. To gather intelligence. It's there's something called the Quarles exception. It's a case you can look up, in which case the FBI, U.S. law enforcement, is allowed to hold, to not Mirandize someone, to not read them their Miranda rights, while they gather information from them that could threaten American citizens, you know, cause immediate harm. Now, they can't use any of that information that they gather through standard interrogation, Q&A, just building rapport. They can't use that in the trial, but they can use that, you know, to say, hey, if this guy gives up two or three of the guys he was working with on the night of the attack in Benghazi in 2012 that killed a U.S. ambassador and three other Americans, they will try to act on that as quickly as possible. Then the other team comes in and questions him, and that's when they advise him of his rights, and he has the option to shut up or to keep talking. In some cases, some of these suspects, like the Somali pirate that they grabbed a couple years back and held on a ship and interrogated for months, he just kept talking.
Jack, what do you think? Will this apprehension, this arrest, cool the Benghazi issue or give it legs, inflame it?
Well, you know, it could well cool it because I'm quoting now from the New York Times. He told, this Katalla told fellow Islamist fighters and others that the assault was retaliation for the insulting video. Well, here we are to the first Susan Rice talking point that was, you know, that ignited the whole controversy. It wasn't a result of the video. Well, here's the perpetrator, or at least part of this, saying, yeah, it was the result of the video. We were stirred up. Well, I don't know. Will the Republicans say that he's part of the cover-up too? Stay tuned.
Let's go to Kevin in Sumter, South Carolina. Kevin, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I just call on, regardless of what political side you're on, seeing whether in action or, you know, not enough action. It's great that we actually caught somebody, but the American people, what really has to happen is we have to move out and draw fire now and get this guy to court. We've got to get it to trial. It's got to happen. The American people need it. I mean, it's because he's a very painful event for everybody within America, and we can't wait 2 years to have a court case. And then the court case drag out for two more years and then finally ends up in Supermax. I mean, it really needs to happen now.
Do it and do it fast. But you know how the court system works. I wonder. I appreciate your call, Kevin. James Oliphant, what about it? This trial, the timetable. Do you see closure in this, which is kind of what our caller suggests? And what about a likely timetable? Do you have any sense of it, James?
Well, a lot of it just depends on the cooperation of the suspect. So, but if he wants to put up a defense, then, you know, the wheels of justice are no different for suspected terrorists than they are, you know, drug runners or anybody else. And they move slowly. I'm sure that the Justice Department will move with all appropriate speed. But, you know, we just don't have the kind of country where someone can be arrested and convicted in a matter of months.
Kimberly, we've got to ask you out the side of our vision here about Ukraine. While all these other things have blown up, huge stuff afoot, what's going on? Is Ukraine stabilizing? Or we heard about Russian tanks in there. We heard about 40-plus Ukrainian central government soldiers shot down in one plane brought down. Stabilizing or still coming undone, Kimberly?
Not really stabilizing. The Ukrainian president, Petro Poroshenko, reached out to Russian President Putin and offered a ceasefire agreement in which the pro-Russian fighters would be allowed to leave the country. But what's happened is while each side is making the right noises in phone conversations, even yesterday, NATO is reporting that Russian troops are moving again towards the Ukrainian border, and there was fighting with rebels overnight that killed more Ukrainian soldiers. So, you know, while we see these moves towards rapprochement on the ground, it seems like they're still moving ahead towards continuing, if not worsening, this crisis.
Let's bring this very much home. As we speak, hearings going on in Washington on the IRS and their oversight of groups that were involved in politics, not-for-profit, who they investigated, who they didn't, the charge that they went after conservative groups, the IRS that they went after everybody. But now the emails that might have clarified this, missing, lost in a computer crash, not just for Lois Lerner, who was the head of the IRS during this period, but for a half dozen others. Paul Ryan, really hot under the collar this morning here, saying, you know, taxpayers have to keep tax records for 7 years. The IRS can't keep emails for 6 months. James Oliphant, the notion that all these people would have lost emails, whatever you think of this whole controversy, whether it's worthy or not, the idea that all these emails would be lost seems kind of, it strains credulity, James.
It's the dog ate my homework defense. It's the classic. There has always been, Tom, two competing narratives in this, and that's true for a lot of Washington scandals, which is it's government incompetence and a lack of thorough oversight versus conspiracy, right? So from the IRS's perspective, this was a monitoring operation, a screening process for these nonprofit groups that went awry. There was a lack of internal controls. There was a lack of quality control. And to them, it's sort of a bureaucratic foul-up. And to the Republicans, it's a conspiracy to deny these tax-exempt groups their status. And I think what we're seeing is all of this coming to a head now. And to the great frustration of Republicans, it doesn't seem like there's a great deal they can do about it if these hard drives have, in fact, been rewritten and recycled. That material seems to be gone.
Boy, but if everybody can use the dog ate my homework defense, I don't know where we go in terms of accountability here. And then, of course, we have a new Republican majority leader in the House after the stunning defeat last week by Eric Cantor in the primaries there. Kevin McCarthy out of Bakersfield, California, newly elected House Majority Leader. In an interview yesterday with a local news station, 23ABC in Bakersfield, he talked about changes he'd like to make in his new leadership role. Kevin McCarthy.
You know, we could have a national energy policy, Breedland, the infrastructure to make us not be buying from overseas. We could have a tax reform to make sure that it's simpler, fairer, that people get to keep more, that we're able to move forward in the process. We could do better in education. We have 1 million kids in America today on a waiting list for a charter school. Why would we hold them back? We can streamline government. I want a government that's efficient, effective, and doesn't take $1 extra.
Jack Beatty, holy smokes, we're going to have an action-oriented Congress all of a sudden here. Is Kevin McCarthy going to come in and act on energy, on infrastructure, on tax reform, on education? Is that the path we're on, Jack?
Well, he may act on those things, but not in a way that the Senate will react favorably to. I mean, he will come up with partisan legislation. The House has passed legislation. It just has gone nowhere in the Senate because it's not the difference in the parties. You know, he's a pretty interesting fellow. I've been just reading about him. One thing, he sleeps in his office. That brings him sort of plain guy cred.
Makes it cheaper to live in Washington that way.
Yeah, it makes it cheaper to live in Washington. And he's described as affable, you know. I don't know that Eric Cantor was very affable. And so these things argue for a good politician. He's apparently light on policy, but that's not his main job. And then the other person who won, his replacement essentially, is the new whip, Steve Scalise of Louisiana. Mm-hmm. Well, he was handing out at his rally red baseball bats to show his, you know, this is how I'm going to whip I'm not going to use a whip. I'm going to use these red baseball bats.
Great.
But the red indicates something very important. And the Southern GOP was saying, look, we're a big part of this caucus. We have very few committee chairmen. We got to have something. And that Scalise won on the first ballot, I think really suggests that his colleagues took that and said, yeah, you do deserve something. And he is from the most conservative wing of the party. He's the head of the Republican study group. And as one of his colleagues from Louisiana said, now the leadership, which had been sort of to the center of the caucus, has now moved a degree with Scalise's taking the job.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, toward the caucus, so that there's it is a more conservative caucus overall.
James Oliphant, look up Pennsylvania Avenue from the White House for a second. Kevin McCarthy's come up so fast, quite young, and there's talk of John Boehner's retirement. Is this young California politician already in line or locking up the Speaker of the House future?
I think that's the kind of speculation that got Eric Cantor in trouble, right? Because he was always viewed as a guy who was looking upward and not backward at his home district, and that ended up really damaging him. As much as it was a Tea Party rebellion in a way, it was also a lack of care to the home folks. So one thing Kevin McCarthy has to do in the immediate short term is hold on to this job for the long haul. And, the conservatives that Jack mentioned, they're not completely placated by McCarthy. They're still distrustful of Boehner and the leadership. Scalise is now in there as a check on to prevent them from moving too far to the center. So McCarthy really has sort of a trial period here. And in the fall, the conservatives will have another opportunity to challenge him. And definitely by 2016, if they don't feel like he's getting it done, they're going to find someone, be it Jeb Hensarling or somebody else, to run against him or perhaps vault over him when Boehner does decide to step down or is replaced.
James, take it all the way to the arena here. Washington Redskins, what's the betting in the Capitol? Are they going to hang on to that name? Or in the era of Donald Sterling and lots of talk about racism in professional sports, you know, they can't use their trademark unless they win an appeal there. Do they hang on to their name or finally let it go? What do you think, James?
Well, you do get the feeling here that they're going to have to pry that name out of Dan Snyder's cold, dead hands. I mean, it's he is the biggest piece of obstruction to changing the name. He is adamant about not doing it. It seems like history and social forces are lining against him. But I think he's going to hold out as long as he can, Tom.
Sterling in the West, Snyder in the East with his Redskins. We'll see what happens right there. James Oliphant with the National Journal. Thanks for joining us, James.
My pleasure.
Kimberly Dozier at Daily Beast. Thank you so much, Kim.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Songwriter Jerry Goffin died this week at 75. He wrote so many songs with Carole King. Here, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.